We've come here to the last of our lessons in this book, Portraits of Discipleship. And it is the disciples' task, fishers of men. And ultimately, we only have two purposes: to get ourselves to heaven and to bring as many people with us as we can. We phrase that in other ways of love God and love your neighbor, but it means the same thing. And so this last lesson is kind of a summary lesson where we've talked about needing to be an athlete and needing to be moldable as the clay and needing to have these different characteristics that we've mentioned, but ultimately it comes down to, are we being who we're called to be? The first page, it's, page 77 here in the book. He says, fish are caught with a net, lost souls are caught with the gospel. So how does the gospel catch a lost soul? I've mentioned before, I wonder a little bit about his metaphors sometimes in this book.
The purpose of a lure is to persuade the fish to tide. So the purpose of the gospel is to persuade men to accept Christ. So in that way, I guess it's a decent question to ask.
When he goes on to say they're caught with the gospel and not gimmicks and food and fun and frolic, etc. Extending the metaphor is a little challenging here, because you certainly can catch people with all of those other things. And so this is not talking about the effect of, have I caught people enough? The point of being fishers of men is not that you're catching people. The point of being fishers of men is that you are going out there and you are trying to seek out amongst the world. Especially fishing with nets, you end up pulling in a lot of stuff that you don't really care to. And if you're having a bad day, I'm thinking like Forrest Gump when he started shrimp fishing. And he'd throw out the net and he'd come back with like a boot or something like that. Maybe two shrimp and a boot, and that's what he'd get when he cast his net out. Or you go out and you cast your net and you end up getting the garbage fish, right? Yeah, you got fish, but you didn't get the fish that you intended. And what you're wanting to accomplish with your net is you're wanting to select out of the pool, out of the sea, the fish that are set apart, the fish that are holy. So who are we trying to catch? We're fishers of men. Who are we trying to catch? This will go to why the different things they talk about there with the pop psychology and the gimmicks and whatnot won't catch these people, or at least if it does catch these people, it's an accident, and why the gospel will catch them. Who are we trying to catch?
Well, we're trying to catch the lost. To go more deeply into that, more specifically, we're trying to catch the honest hearts. That's how I would phrase that. Because, as you said, probably the gimmicks, they're not going to work for the people. They're not going to work. The gospel is not going to work for the honest hearts. And so we're looking for those that are honest.
an honest heart or a love for the truth. And it could be people that have never heard it before. It could be people that's the particular moment that it pricks their heart. A lot of the people in Acts 2 had heard about all this stuff before, but it was in Acts 2, in the words of the apostles and the words of Peter, was when it hit them, when it worked. Maybe we can extend our fishing analogy there. I know there have been many times that I've cast the exact same lure or the exact same kind of worm into the water, and it didn't do anything. And then one time I throw it in there, they're biting all day. What in the world happened? I don't have a clue what happened. But
they weren't hungry.
They weren't interested. It was the wrong time of day. They weren't in the mood. Who knows, these crazy fish. But ultimately, they have to want it. And they have to be in the right mindset to want it. The bottom there, it says, why should we be fishers of men? Why should disciples of Jesus be concerned with making more disciples? What is our motivation? That's what the rest of the lesson focuses on. We definitely don't want to be stingy with the gospel. That is not the way to think about it. We want to save as many people as we can. Why? We did talk about that back, I forget, in lesson 3 or 4, how we have a debt to all people. And we had that question, well, what is our debt to all people? And of course, we have the call to love our neighbor. And who is our neighbor? Our neighbor is anybody. Anybody we are around. And therefore, every person we're around is an opportunity. And maybe some are more profitable than others, but as Debbie mentioned, we may not be able to tell that just by looking at the situation. I think about the sower. You know, when I first thought about the sower when I was little, like say 4 or 5 years old, I'm like, well, this guy is not very careful. He's just throwing seed all over the place. I'd help my papa in the garden. And if there were, you know, if I got the black eyed peas just scattered all over wherever, you know, in the ditches and everything else, he was not going to be happy with me. He wanted them right in the row that he had hoed where he intended for those to go. And he wanted them in their particular place, and he wanted the watermelon seeds in their particular place. He didn't want it all mixed up. And I hear the parable of the sower, and he's just flinging seeds all over the place. Of course, I came to find out later that you don't sow wheat the same way that you do peas and watermelons, but you know, wisdom comes with age, I suppose. What would lead somebody to not be motivated? What would lead a Christian to not be motivated to be sharing the gospel? Fear of rejection? What else? Bitterness. How so?
So I'm thinking along those lines, the temptation to feel bitter by the way that
could even be bitterness you get from the rejection. Because there is the fear of rejection and how that might impact relationships and things like that. But there's also a lot of rejection. You go out there trying to spread the gospel, you're going to get a lot of rejection. And that can make you bitter too, where you're just like, well, do I really want to go and talk to another person just to have them mock the faith? Do I really want to? And there's a reason that we're commanded to not become weary in well doing. It's because it's a risk. There's a risk out there to do that. Hey, Josh? Yeah, I've heard the example before where you have like, a bunch of people that are heading down the road towards a bridge that's out or a cliff or something like that. And it's a message that's meant to encourage us to not grow weary, because it's like, well, at what point are you going to be like, ah, sick of warning people about flying off this cliff? You're really just going to stand there and watch people fly off the cliff? But the fact of the matter is that if you continue the metaphor, that's exactly what ends up happening. Where it's like, seems like nothing I do is effective, or it becomes moot in the long run. There's a lot of thought about thinking, well, maybe I'm not ready, or maybe I'm not good enough, or maybe they'll ask questions and I won't know the answers to them. It's not the example we have in the Bible. The example we have in the Bible is people go out there and they fling the word everywhere, just like that sower. Sometimes that leads to missteps. Paul had a misstep when he was talking about the high priest. Wasn't good. Sometimes we don't operate ideally. I've wondered that before about Stephen. What Stephen preached wasn't wrong, and Stephen preached very similarly to how Peter preached in Acts 2, and we compare that sometimes. We go, well, look at the hearts of the people out there. These people were pricked in their heart and came to repentance. These people were pricked in their heart and came to stone Stephen. And so I wonder, well, am I reacting too far the other way? Where it's like, well, Stephen, you know, you got to know your audience. Was that a time where you should have dusted off your feet and moved on because of the audience that was there? Or is that me having my own problem? Where I'm thinking, like what Audrey was saying, where it's like, well, is this the right time? Overanalyzing my situation and getting analysis paralysis, where I end up thinking too much about it and end up doing nothing at all. And there are other things we could say. We could talk about being shy. We could talk about past failures making us timid to try again. There are lots of things that could drive us the other way. The interesting thing is, all of these, every single one of these things is solved the same way. And that is by preparing yourself with a family, study. Every single one of these is solved that way. Your fear of rejection, you can go to the psychologist and see the experiments, but you can just look anecdotally. You will be less afraid to fail if you go with somebody. You'll be less afraid to fail if you practice. You'll be less afraid to fail if you prepare yourself. We see this in silly things all the time. You see people that's a good example. Like at Florida College Summer Camp. They got talent shows and things like that at Florida College Summer Camp. And it can be hard to get up there and make a fool of yourself in a talent show. But somehow it's easier if 10 of your buddies go up there and all 11 of you make fools of yourselves at once. Somehow that's easier. Well, why? It's the psychology of it. But it works the same way here. If I go to speak with somebody with you, then I've got the confidence built up in me of being with you. I've got the confidence built up in me of having your faith alongside my faith, of having your confidence alongside my confidence. And they feed one another, and they support one another, and you walk in there in a better situation. We know this. We know this as people. You can see it in simple things. Do you ever notice that the Mormons always show up at your house in twos? There's a reason they do that. An obvious reason. Jesus sent people out. It was the 72 he sent out, right? And he sent them out in pairs. There's a reason that we do these things. I think about it. We become fishers of men because we're following Jesus. To give us a sense of purpose was an interesting one that I was thinking about. And I know that I'm feeling awfully philosophical this morning. Rachel asked me if there were any questions I was going to put on Facebook, and I went, nope, my brain is too scrambled. I think my body is busy trying to heal whatever's ill with me, not letting my brain operate and translate as well as it normally does. But there's something that atheists like to throw at religious people, not just Christians, all religious people. When they talk about, well, the Bible is my moral compass. The Bible tells me right and wrong. The Bible is my guidepost. And you'll have somebody who's apparently not good at debating ask the atheist something like, you know, well, what tells you something's right or wrong? Like, why don't you go around just murdering and robbing to get richer and things like that? Why don't you just go around murdering and robbing as much as you want? And the atheist will say, I do. I do go around murdering and robbing as much as I want. I don't want to do those things at all, so I don't do them. It gets back to something we talked about last week about being an apologist, that if you go and you try to be too clever when you're an apologist, you'll end up walking yourself down a path that actually is counterproductive to the word. And you end up, if not driving people away, at least not bringing people to Christ. Very important for us to remember to keep things simple. Be like Paul, I determined to know nothing among you except Christ crucified. But what would life be like? How would you live your life if God had never told us what to do? That's an interesting question to ask. And then how do you live your life differently because God has told us what to do? And I think the biggest way is that there is this concept of salvation. In general, I would try not to hurt people if I didn't believe in God or if God had just never told us to do anything. Because when I've been hurt, I don't like it. And I don't want other people to experience things that they won't like. But the idea of being fishers of men has to come back to that sense that we are on a rescue mission constantly. It's So we're given that sense of purpose, but the sense of purpose is driven by an urgency. So we go back to the example of the people driving off the cliff. That's an urgent situation. They're falling to their doom. You would do whatever in the world. You'd be out there putting obstacles in the road just to slow them down so that maybe they could see the bridge was out before they went flying off of it. You'd work until you were exhausted, until you couldn't work anymore. I'm talking too much. I'm not letting y'all talk enough. Y'all can talk about any of these things. I already told you my brain's frazzled today.
Justin, one of the things you asked about why would people refuse or be hesitant to preach, all of those things are legitimate. But I do think that there is an ultimate point that needs to be made that would cause, or if a person did have this in him, would cause him to overcome that despite his feelings of insecurity and all. And that is, and I think this is evident what we talked about earlier with Paul, it ultimately, if you're not doing the Lord's work, it's an ingratitude towards the gift of grace that God has given you. And there's a kind of an absolute in that. There may be other things, but what Paul did, despite any insecurities he might have or his circumstances in life, he determined to preach the gospel to every creature as God intended for him to do. It wasn't easy for him. It was very hard for him. But because of that great debt he felt he owed, and the reason he owed it to men, is because God had given him that position. God had given him that grace. God had given him that salvation. Knew that his responsibility was to share that same opportunity with others, or else he wasn't doing what God would have him do as a steward. So he was willing to overcome anything he could in order to do it anyway. So I think that idea of ingratitude needs to be at the forefront of our minds, is that are you expressing proper gratitude toward God because of what he's given you, his gift of grace? So, all these excuses or problems you might have are problems, but you got to work on it. You got to do it anyway because God expects it.
Yeah.
And also, just without, we have to look for the opportunity. You're in such a rush day to day, and a lot of us around the same people, so we know we're going here or there, and we need to stop and say, okay, help me to see the opportunity to share this with somebody. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Pray for opportunities and to recognize them, and then hopefully we'll be more ready to do what we need to do.
Yeah, and kind of to what some others have said, don't make that too specific. You know, it's not one of those, I'm looking for the opportunity. God, please give me an opportunity. And you're like, well, is that an opportunity? I don't know. No, that's not the way Jesus described the harvest. He described the field white with harvest. You weren't going to walk through the field and be like, is that one wide enough? Is that one wide enough? You know, looking for the perfect bit. He's like, there's more work than you could possibly do. And that, by the way, is something that also discourages us sometimes, at least some of us. I don't know if you've ever, you're going to clean your house or whatnot, and you like clean on it for 2 or 3 hours, and you look at it, and you're like, I can't even tell it anything. What is the point? And we see some people that get weary like that in the Bible, where they're just like, why am I even doing anything? And in some cases they got comforted, and in some cases they got chastised. But I think what Stan's saying is absolutely right. It's a perspective thing. You know, with the harvest even, it's a perspective thing. The harvest is white. There are opportunities everywhere. Jesus had the right perspective to see that. We need to have that right perspective. I've used that example of my sister-in-law before, who mentioned that it was easier for her to do things around the house, whatever, just simple things, wash dishes or whatever in the world, when she thought about those things as expressions of love towards her family, rather than thinking about them as chores. And I think that's an important thing with the work that we do spreading the gospel, is getting that right perspective on it, getting that perspective that every little piece that you do is a glory to God, it's a blessing to get to do it, and it brings you closer to God. It is one of those things, like with the 99 and 1, with the sheep or the lady with the lost coin and stuff like that, where the joy of success should overwhelm any of the work in it. And of course, we've talked about the perspective before about, you know, what is an entire life of work here compared to eternity. You get that song, "You Never Mentioned Him to Me." My goodness, that is a sad song. That is such a sad song. And I wonder sometime, because I spend enough time second-guessing the choices of my life about everything, absolutely everything. Probably something in my psychology. But I think to myself, I'm not going to do that in heaven. But I can't imagine the Justin of today not doing that. I can't imagine the Justin of today not looking back on his life and going, oh, I missed that chance to talk to that person. I missed this chance. Stan talks sometimes about talking to people later in life and they didn't obey until later in life, and how much they regret that they didn't. And part of what they're regretting is that they squandered those opportunities that Debbie mentioned. So many opportunities they could have had to save other people. And the sorrow they have. The people that are already dead by the time they obey, that they're never going to get a chance to talk to. And that they know died in a lost condition, and so they will never see. I have to think about everyone as fellow children of God. We've got that passage, forget if it's Romans 14 or 1 Corinthians 8, one or the other, where Paul describes any other human being as someone for whom Christ died. So God sat there and was willing to sacrifice his son for literally every single person we see. That's how much worth every single person we see has to God. We're back to that perspective. We need to have that perspective that makes them that valuable in our mind. I'm not even following these slides at all. I'll keep flipping them. We already mentioned about there being a great need. The field is white with harvest. That's the difference about how Jesus looks at the world and how we can be tempted to look at the world. And of course Jesus was, but never succumbed to the temptation. Some of the things we talked about before, Jesus felt these things. Jesus felt overwhelmed, and he responded with prayer and meditation. And Jesus didn't have to fear rejection. He knew he was going to be rejected. You can still fear something you know is coming. You can see when Jesus thinks about it, when he sits there and says to Israel, you know, how many times have I wanted like a mother hen to to bring you under my wings and protect you. And of course, he had had millennia of getting to watch Israel and others walk away, do the spiritual adultery that's described in the Old and New Testament. But he vividly saw, never lost sight of the tragedy of the people that were going over the cliff, never to return. It's hard for us to even visualize that, conceptualize that. We're not very good at thinking about really big numbers. 8 billion people on the earth, that's hard to wrap your brain around. And one of the tragedies that I think that we maybe do a better job with is when we start talking about the numbers related to abortion. We talk about how many babies die because of abortion. And you can go look up the numbers. You can see how many died in the U.S., in Texas, in Tarrant County. And you look at babies and you just imagine that many more. We should be able to visualize the lost souls the same way, and how tragic that is. There in section 4 on page 79, the last paragraph reads, "There is a need for those who have the truth to share it with the lost. Those lost in sin are not laboring in the harvest." The people that are lost are not out there working. And Jesus lamented that the laborers were few. Those promoting error are sabotaging the harvest. How tragic is that? The bridge is out up ahead. Stop, stop, stop. Somebody goes, "You don't have to stop, just get in the left lane." And they go right off the end of the bridge and die. People thinking they're safe, and they're not safe. Lazy and indifferent Christians are ignoring the harvest. We must respond as Isaiah and say, "Here am I, send me." Ultimately, we're fishers of men because it's the right thing to do. He calls back to 2 Kings 7, and he's talking about the lepers. And this was the case where the Syrian camp had been abandoned, and they go into the camp and they say, "Our ship's come in. Look at this. There's new clothes." They hadn't get to get new clothes. What happened to lepers? They walked around and their clothes literally rotted off of them and got infected from the wounds and stuff like that. People weren't going to waste clothes on them. Here there were new clothes. There was food. There were items of luxury that they couldn't even use, but they still wanted because it felt like such a windfall. And then they said to one another, "We're not doing right. This day is a day of good news, and we remain silent. If we wait until morning, some punishment will come upon us. Now therefore, come, let us go and tell the king's household." Remaining silent about the hope of salvation is a sin. Let's be clear on that. You cannot be a Christian in good standing with God if you aren't spreading the gospel. Look at Jonah. I don't know that Jonah was ever in a good standing with God the entire book of Jonah. Yeah, he went and preached. I don't see any evidence that his heart was ever right with God, even when he was preaching to the Ninevites. He went outside the city afterward to wait and see if God would destroy him. He wasn't interested in their salvation. He wasn't interested in supporting the harvest. We mentioned before, but ultimately it's our duty. We have a job to do. And that job to do is because of the debt we owe. So many parables about that. The person who gets their debt forgiven, an enormous debt beyond anything they could ever pay, and then they won't go forgive someone else. Or you can imagine a group of starving people and someone comes and brings food, but they don't tell the rest of the people about the food and they go off and hoard it away for themselves. No, we have a duty. We have an obligation. The top of page 80, talking about the watchman. However, when he fails to sound the warning, the blood of the people is on his head. In that passage, it says that if you see the enemy coming and you sound the alarm and everyone goes, meh, whatever, that's on them. But you're the watchman and you don't sound the alarm and the army comes in and destroys everyone, that's on you. I mentioned before the joy of saving souls. That is an amazing feeling. I hope everyone here has got a chance to feel that. But it is an amazing feeling when you bring the Word of God to somebody. It pricks their heart. They respond. They come to God. I don't suppose that I'll ever feel the amount of joy and the amount of zeal that I felt the moment I came up out of the water. But I'll tell you that the second closest I've ever gotten, and there's a big tie for second, is when other people have come up out of that water. And even more so when I had a hand in it. Is that necessarily the right way to think about it? I don't know. But you see people in the New Testament celebrate the opportunities they've had to teach people. Celebrate the opportunities they've had to plant. Celebrate the opportunities that they've had to water. Question number 10 out of the lesson was, why is Paul innocent of the blood of all men? That is a reference to Acts 20, verse 26 and 27. It says, therefore I testify to you this day that I am innocent of the blood of all men, for I did not shrink from declaring to you the whole purpose of God. He's talking to Ephesus at that point. There are plenty of times where Paul described how guilty he was of the deaths of various people, consenting to Stephen's death, hauling Christians into prison, and various things. How can he be innocent of the blood of all men? What does Paul mean? Is Spoiler alert, we've already answered the question. I'm just trying to get you all to answer it again. Brought the whole counsel of God. He brought it all to them. It goes in large part back to what Stan was saying before. Grace covered the past, and then he had a duty, and he had an obligation, and he fulfilled that. Think about the parable where the people were called at the different times of the day. And I mentioned this, I forget, last week or the week before, but they were called at the various different times of the day. But once they were called, they had a duty. They had an obligation. They had to be in that field working. And one of them only worked for an hour. One of them worked for like 13 hours. They all got the same pay. But the only people that got paid were the people that worked. Next week, Stan will have a lesson, and then we will start the parables in January. Thank you all.